world has learned a lot about pandemics in the last year and a half, and today on the show we'll talk about one way to get in front of the next virus. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Two guests for you today from UW-Madison. One, David O'Connor, the UW Medical Foundation Professor of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at UW. Welcome, David. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having us.
Shelby O'Connor is an associate professor in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine, our other guest. Welcome, Shelby.
Thanks for having us.
So as we talk with these two experts, I hope you'll join in. They're part of an effort to link public health and academia together, and love to hear what you think. Join in. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Well, let's maybe start with some background. Is maybe talk about the effort to create an international pandemic prevention institute. What's the backstory on that, David?
Sure. So one thing that we haven't talked as much about as we have the health impacts of COVID is the economic impacts. And it's been estimated that the COVID-19 pandemic has cost already tens of trillions of dollars in terms of lost economic output, economic growth that would have otherwise occurred. And what we need to be asking ourselves is, given the massive cost of COVID-19, what can we do to prepare ourselves so that when there's COVID-36 or COVID-51, we don't see those same sorts of enormous costs? And the answer is making investments now so that we're better prepared next time, that we're not caught off guard, and that we can work together both locally and globally to mitigate the impacts of future infectious disease threats.
Interesting. How did UW-Madison get involved in this? Shelby, you want to take that?
So we're part of this Pandemic Preparedness Institute that you had mentioned before. There are regional accelerators that are all funded through the Rockefeller Institute, and we are one of four regional accelerators that's part of this larger group. Our regional accelerator contains Marshfield Clinic up in the northern part of Wisconsin, Milwaukee Public Health on the eastern side, Madison, Wisconsin, of course, and then in Minnesota, we have the University of Minnesota and then the Mayo Clinic. So we have five different sites that are all part of our regional accelerator group. And our real goal is to try to identify and develop new ways that we can surveil for viruses in the community so that we're not caught sort of on our back foot, where we can detect these viruses more quickly and respond to them also more quickly moving forward in the future.
Maybe you talk a bit about what your labs are researching and then how it fits into what this new institute is doing. Shelby, yeah, go ahead.
We have a couple of different areas of research in our labs. I'll talk about some, and I'll let Dave talk about some of the other ones. One of the unique and innovative ways that we're trying to surveil for these viruses in our community is through air sampling. And I think you mentioned that earlier in your introduction. And so what we're trying to do is figure out where we can put air samplers that are made by Thermo Fisher in the community, whether it's K-12 schools, transport hubs, eating locations, eating establishments, and where we can essentially suck in the air and the environment and collect any of the virus particles that are in the air, and then take out a substrate from the instrument on which we can then look for virus particles. So we can look for SARS-CoV-2. We could look for influenza outbreaks. We could look for RSV outbreaks in all these different communities. And right now we're trying to explore how these systems, how these instruments work in the real world, how we can work with them, and then how these different groups, whether they're schools or eating establishments or athletic facilities, how they can respond to them. And this is a real a real partnership between academic research and public health.
Yeah, and I'll add to this that when we think about pandemic preparedness, it's not any one stakeholder. It's not just university labs or hospitals or doctors or public health or companies. It's all of the above. It's all of us working together. And frankly, the systems for having those groups work together weren't optimal at the start of the pandemic. They're not optimal now. We have to break down some of the silos that have historically existed between some of these groups so that when we're trying something like this air sampling that Shelby was talking about, we have to figure out, well, what does the technology look like? And as university researchers, we're good at technology and virology. But what is working with the different stakeholders in the community look like? What does working with public health look like? And our background is in HIV research, where for four decades, people who are affected by HIV/AIDS have been working in their communities, have been advocates, have been speaking up, and have been really laying the groundwork for this kind of multi-sector response. But we need to amplify and enhance that when we think about trying to prevent respiratory virus outbreaks and other types of pandemics in the future. And we need to work collaboratively to overcome the hurdles that we're going to have, because the question of what of the many different technologies that are available would actually have a meaningful effect, would have make a meaningful difference in terms of preventing the next COVID, is something that's still a really open question right now. And it's something that lots of different people, depending on their vantage point, might come to different solutions about what looks like the right, best next steps.
You mentioned silos. I'm wondering why in the past has it been difficult to just not have this cross-fertilization going on?
Well, I'll give you one example. So when the pandemic started, we were sequencing viruses. So everyone's now heard about the Delta variant and the Mu variant and the Alpha variant. But back in the start of the pandemic, we were sequencing viruses from people who were infected throughout Wisconsin so that we could use the virus's sequence as a form of a fingerprint to track its spread over time and space. And we would generate a sequence of a virus from a person who was infected somewhere in Wisconsin. And we wanted to be able to share this with scientists in other states to ask whether or not the virus from Eau Claire happens to be seen, a genetically similar or identical virus happens to be seen in Minnesota or in Iowa. But it turns out that there were lots of well-intentioned rules that were put into place before the start of the pandemic that restrict the sharing of that kind of information publicly or with other scientists, such that even now, if you go to the CDC's webpage showing viral variants right now, what you would see is that you only get a smoothing of all the sequence data for all of California in their map of the country. There's no differentiation between the viruses that are circulating in Los Angeles and those that are circulating in San Francisco. And that's because you have these rules that really prevent granular sharing of data between groups who might benefit from them. And so one of the things we really need to do is we need to work to figure out what sort of regulatory guardrails are appropriate during normal times, and then what sort of modifications might be acceptable during emergency situations to make sure that they're not impeding public health, they're not impeding our understanding of the science. And it turns out, whether you're a scientist or not, I'm sure you've encountered bureaucracy in your day-to-day life, and it's the exact same thing. It's sort of bureaucracy that just doesn't make sense when you hold it up to the bright light of an epidemic like this. But it takes a lot of time to make changes to it so that we're going to be better prepared for next time.
Go ahead, Shelby.
I was just going to add to that sort of another conversation that we've been having among the different regional accelerators through this program is, what if person X comes in and gets a test? They want to know what their virus sequence looks like. They want to know if they got infected with Delta. Can I sequence their virus and tell them what they have? And the answer to that is no, I cannot. Because of some of these different regulatory guardrails that are in place, Someone who is infected is not allowed to then have someone sequence their virus and tell them what they're infected with, because of just different privacy rules as well. So it's just something that's been coming up quite regularly. And I think that that there's an interest in trying to figure out how we can break down these barriers like that, but they just don't exist right now.
So maybe part of the role of the Institute, along with sharing information, is doing a little, I don't know if politicking is the right word, but doing a little bit of work to sort of get some of those rules changed or altered. Is that, or is that not correct?
No, that's absolutely right. So some of it is the rules, and then some of it is also the conversations within the community. So let's return to this idea of these air samplers. So say we have a machine that can collect the air in the lobby of a K-12 school. So your kid's junior high. And then say that this machine is running all the time and it's just kind of whirring along in the background, and you test it every day for the presence of COVID genetic material. And say you find some COVID genetic material. Well, then what? So the then what from the parent perspective might look different than the then what from the teacher perspective, or from the teacher's union perspective, or the superintendent or the school administration's perspective. And that might look different again from what public health might want to do or know about that information. So a lot of this is handholding, going into it together, working through problems as they arise, and really being as patient as possible and understanding that with so many people who have different perspectives on the same situation, we need to do strong consensus building so that we can move together collectively.
So if I can add to that, the guardrails are in place for a reason, protecting individual privacy, trying to make sure that we don't have conflicts of interest. Like, these things are in place for a reason. And so I think, as Dave says, we need to understand what they are and try to come to a consensus as for the best way to move forward to break down whatever barriers we can break down, but allowing people to maintain that privacy.
We'll take some calls now. You can join in if you have a question or comment. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. Duncan in Appleton's online. Let's go there. Duncan, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, everyone, over this, you know, vaccinations and immunizations, I'm on Wikipedia, and the Chinese in the 1500s and all the other vaccines over the centuries, you know, to save people from dying. And in Milwaukee, there's a news thing called The Onion, and I have to write it. We're expected to follow along blindly with the CDC, but if people would simply look to the history, they'd see that thousands of people who were inoculated against smallpox in the 1800s have since dropped dead, said Dixon, telling reporters it was disgusting and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, like, okay, that's all I got to say, I think.
So,
David, go ahead.
So, thanks, Duncan. Yeah, I mean, there has been so much conversation about the vaccines. And I can tell you again that from my perspective, I've spent my entire adult life studying vaccines for infectious diseases. I've been working on HIV vaccines since the late 1990s, and we have struggled mightily in the HIV vaccine field. It's now been more than 40 years, and we don't have a vaccine that effectively prevents people from getting infected with HIV, getting sick, and dying of AIDS. The fact that we have one for SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, is a miracle. It is a modern medical miracle, all right? And it's a miracle in part because this is an easy virus to make a vaccine against. There is a very specific type of immune response called a neutralizing antibody response that correlates very, very well with protection against the virus that causes COVID. And it's relatively easy for vaccines to make these neutralizing antibodies, to make your body make these neutralizing antibodies against COVID. And that matters because what it means is that once you get vaccinated with the COVID vaccine, you're not going to get sick with COVID. You're not going to develop severe illness. You're not as likely to pass away. You see this in all the hospital stats. If you had told me, as someone who studied vaccines my entire life, that we would have a pandemic like this and we would have this miraculous vaccine within a year, but then people are choosing not to take it, I don't think I would have believed you. I think I would have said that that's an Onion article, that people are, you know, choosing not to get a vaccine because they just want to take their chances. It just makes no sense. And I think that I share President Biden's frustration with the impact that the high rate of vaccine hesitancy is causing hospitals to be busier than they need to be, is causing morticians to be busier than they need to be, and that this is now a pandemic largely of the unvaccinated. And I understand that there is reluctance, I understand that there is hesitation, but these vaccines are a gift horse. And not only are people looking the gift horse in the mouth, they're punching the gift horse in the face, elbowing it in the head, and trying to do everything they can to, you know, take this truly remarkable, you know, scientific triumph and make it not help as much as it could. And that's just tragic.
Talking today with a couple of professors from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, David O'Connor, UW Medical Foundation, Professor of Pathology and Lab Medicine at UW, Shelby O'Connors, an Associate Professor in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine. I'm talking with them about the efforts to create an international pandemic prevention institute to overcome some of the issues that we've had with this current COVID. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us to ideas@wpr.org. Trina LaSusa and Tyler Ditter, our engineers today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at efforts to create an international pandemic prevention institute. It's actually already here and up and running, and our two guests are talking about it with us, David O'Connor and Shelby O'Connor from the University of Wisconsin. David's the Medical Foundation Professor of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine. Shelby O'Connor, Associate Professor in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine. Take another call. Mike in West Allis, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thanks so much. I really appreciate this topic, and I really appreciate your guest's delivery of the information, because I think a lot of it gets lost sometimes and gets politicized, and I think that this has been extremely informative. One of the things, and I echo the sentiment of what was just said about, you know, about these vaccines and how we rolled this out, you know, and I think, what will we have done back when the mumps or the measles or yellow fever or any of those other ones, if we could have developed a vaccine as quick as we did, you know, how we could have, you know, eliminated some of that, and how our past generations probably would have jumped at an opportunity to not die from something like that in the past. But on top of that, I also wanted to say, didn't we learn anything from 9/11 in sharing and how important it is to share information across these disciplines? Because it seems like we're back to the same issue where we can't get information shared to get things like this moving.
Hmm. Mike, thank you so much. David, you want to take a crack first?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point, Mike. I think that just like 9/11 shocked us into realizing how some of the military and other decision makers needed to work together better to identify threats, that's exactly what we're trying to do with this Pandemic Prevention Institute, is bring people together so that once again, we can make sure that this sort of thing never happens again. And if, when you think about vaccines for other diseases, I think a big part of it, frankly, is that many of us don't know people of our own ages and of our own peer groups who have died of infectious diseases in the United States. I think that the advent of antibiotics and vaccines for all these diseases have bred a complacency where most of us can go through our entire lives Maybe we know an elderly person who dies of pneumonia. Maybe we know someone who has HIV, but these are outliers. These are people who are there. You can look at it and you can say, well, this can't possibly happen to me. Whereas 100 years ago, when you had all these dread diseases, everyone knew people in their families, in their friend groups, who had been directly impacted by these pathogens. And the idea that miracle drugs or miracle vaccines to prevent them could stop that suffering from happening hit home. And I do think that that has led to a lot of the complacency that we're seeing here, is that until people see pictures, until they know people individually who have been affected, it's easy to consider the vaccines as an abstract concept, as something that doesn't necessarily affect you. And hopefully, as time goes on, we will be seeing more vivid and graphic images and videos that remind people of the fact that this virus is no joke. If you get sick, if you have to be hospitalized, it's horrifying, absolutely horrifying.
If I can add to Mike's comment about the whole, it's like 9/11 all over again, I think we need to remember that from a funding perspective, from a government funding perspective, we need to have a well-balanced diet, right? If you put all your money towards protecting, from a defense perspective, maybe you've forgotten that you need to also fund some of the school communities or public health institutes. And so we need to make sure, I think, from the government perspective, that we give both areas some needed resources, because when last winter I was going into K-12 schools and I was teaching nurses how to run antigen tests, they would tell me how they've been sort of forgotten as part of the school system, and they've been forgotten by a lot of the government funding agencies, and the school nurses, need to be remembered that they have a value in the school community and they need to be given the resources that they need. Just as well as sort of defense contractors need to get resources they need. So maintaining that well-balanced diet in funding is just really important.
I wonder if it's that, you're talking, both have mentioned this kind of complacency. Was there a complacency on the federal level? Why weren't we prepared? I mean, it seems like a lot of institutions were caught flat-footed on this. Why weren't we prepared for the pandemic? Was it complacency or what? Something else? David?
Well, I think there certainly were people who have been warning about the potential for a pandemic virus and the impacts that it could have for decades. And certainly even before 2009, when we had a pandemic influenza that fortunately wasn't particularly severe but was highly contagious, we had a lot of people in the influenza research community warning about H5N1 influenza, the bird flu that could cause an epidemic that looks a lot like COVID-19 does today. And there has been significant investment, but I would argue that the amount of investment has not been proportionate to the sort of damage that this sort of pandemic can cause. So even if you have invested a couple of billion dollars in this across all of the different viral threats, when one of these viral threats comes in and costs tens of trillions of dollars, you realize that just like with the defense industry and the Office of Homeland Security after 9/11, there needs to be a better coordinated response to make sure that we can minimize, we'll never be able to eliminate the risk, right? The goal here is never to get to zero, but to minimize the risks as much as we can. And that's just going to require real investments, again, across a lot of sectors. It would be a real shame if, for example, as part of our pandemic initiative, we do a lot of our focus on K-12 schools, as Shelby mentioned. It would be a shame if those schools at some point have brand new shiny instruments to pick virus out of the air, and we can use that to determine what sort of viruses are circulating in schools, but the teachers are still having to dip into their own pockets to buy crayons. That kind of mismatch of resource allocations is also something we have to think about, because eventually, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, virus public health becomes public health without the adjective in front of it. And when that happens, we need to be thinking about, well, how do we optimize for all the things that need to keep kids safe and healthy in schools, not just COVID? And figuring out, again, how to achieve that balance, I think, is going to be really a very difficult but essential question to tackle in the coming years.
Someone else wondered, how are you getting data right now and how can you get it faster?
So we can get sequence data in various ways. We, as you guys know, there's testing that's ongoing in the state regularly, and those nasal swabs that people have performed on them, and if they come up positive, we can usually get some of those residual samples for sequencing, so we can kind of get a sense for what virus sequences are present in the state of Wisconsin as a whole. So essentially residuals, unidentified samples, we can get some of that information. As far as air sampling is concerned, again, like I said, we're running these in different locations in Dane County right now. And so for those, we basically are sucking in air that we are all breathing, and we can collect samples from the cartridges that are run in those machines and detect viruses present there. So we're really just trying to use general surveillance without poking fingers at any individual person. Again, this gets back to that issue of personal privacy. No one wants to be pulled out, but we're able to get these samples from across the state or across our county.
So I'm thinking about the campus just because I'm here and we're here. The field house is filling up virtually every women's volleyball game. Would that be a kind of place where you'd set one of these filters?
Yeah. So, I mean, our women's volleyball team is awesome. So I should always give them a shout out. And again, that is the sort of place you could put these filters or these air samplers. We haven't done much with those sorts of large event samplings yet. It would take a large array of samplers set out somewhere like the field house or Camp Randall in order to really get a result that you think is going to be meaningful, and we'll have blanketed the entire stadium with sampling capacity. Even right now, when we put them in a venue like a school, we're deploying one sampler per school and putting it in a high traffic area like an entryway. And we're uncertain about whether or not we're getting representative data from most of the people who are in the school, what percentage of the school actually walks past the sampler on a particular day. So you could do it in places like the field house. And I think eventually you're going to see that there's going to be initiatives designed to do just that, you know, protect airports, protect and sample large congregate settings. But then again, you also have to ask the question, what do you do with that information? So, I mean, I can tell you right now without having any data that there were people with COVID who were at the Wisconsin game on Saturday night. You just run the math, and you know it would defy statistics if no one was infected, right? So just because you pick up viral genetic material, everyone who's gone to the game has assumed the risk that they were potentially going to be exposed while they were there. You have to really couple the air sampling with what you're going to do depending on the different types of results that you might get from it. So one such thing you could do with the results is you could sequence the viruses out of it. So one of our initial ideas was to put it in the airports, like and the bus depots. And so you could actually sequence the virus and ask, are we seeing variants arriving at the Dane County Airport that aren't circulating in our community? Because the Delta variant has taken over and has been pretty much the only virus we've seen in Dane County for the last 2 months, that has seemed a little less germane right at this very moment. But it's the sort of thing you can do with these samplers when you put them in places where there's large numbers of people. But again, at some point, if these large events are going to happen, people just need to understand the risk that they're taking and the impact that taking that risk has on the health of the broader community.
If I can add a comment to that about the air sampling, yeah, as the question was asked about, you know, where are you getting the data? We're going to be able to determine from the air samplers if they're positive or if they're negative. And just because you have a positive, that's not necessarily the best thing in the world. All it says is, well, we detected virus in the air around us, right? You would hopefully you'd have a negative. And there could be people, as Dave said, passing through, say, the volleyball, the fieldhouse facility, who were positive that came through, but the virus, the air sampler picked up no virus. Well, that could be really good because it might mean that person who was infected, they wore a mask, they were preventing their virus from being expelled into the air and having no virus present actually meant that all the mitigation strategies were working beautifully. So the air samplers could pick up virus in some cases, and then we learn what viruses are there, or they may be negative, and what we're learning is that, hey, we're doing the right things, guys. We're actually trying to protect ourselves from transmitting this virus.
I was at the football game with a 12-year-old friend that I took along, a young boy, and we had our masks on through the whole thing, and we were in a vast, I think, minority of that from that particular game anyway, and I you wonder sometimes what are people thinking maybe about it. Well, what does it cost? This air sampling, for an example, if you were going to set these up in every, you wouldn't set them up in every school or library or in the state, would you, David?
Well, we've done some of the math on this, and we estimate that you could set up an air sampler in every school in the country. And you could screen it for a panel of respiratory viruses once a week for about $2.5 billion a year, which is a lot of money until you realize, again, that COVID has cost tens of trillions of dollars. And that by having a network of these samplers, if we had had a network of these samplers in place in January or February of last year, we likely would have been able to pick up some of the earlier cases of SARS-CoV-2 before people started showing up in the hospitals. And so one of the testable predictions that we have is that this would act as an early warning system, kind of like the earthquake warning systems, where if you start testing for something, so we know that there's a new virus in China or a new virus coming out of Africa or Mexico or wherever it is, you could build that into your testing regime right away. And then you would have all of these places in the country where you could be looking for that virus in the air before people start showing up at hospitals. And that might give you a very brief window in which to act to stop the virus from taking root or taking root as intensively. I mean, as much as we say that what's happened here is inevitable, it isn't. Shelby and I have secondary appointments at the University of Melbourne in Australia. And in Australia, they managed to keep the virus at virtually zero levels for the first 16 months of the pandemic until the arrival of the Delta variant, which is more contagious. And so right now, they aren't able to keep it at zero, but they're still tracking in 1,000 to 2,000 cases a day, whereas we have come to accept 120,000 cases a day as being the cost of doing business. And so I think the difference in the intensity and speed at which they responded provides a great model for why these sorts of investments make sense. If we were in the position to make similar early interventions, if we knew just with a little bit of additional time, and we had coupled that with a really effective public health response, you can imagine that the response to the next pandemic is going to look way, way better than the one did for this one.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. Well, this International Pandemic Prevention Institute, is it really up and running internationally or just getting rolling now?
Well, like all things, it takes some time to get off the ground, but we're talking to the national network of four regional accelerators that Shelby alluded to earlier in about 20 minutes. We have a monthly call where we share our learnings and what we're up to with the U.S. ones. There are a series of international sites that are also involved. I don't know exactly where they are in terms of deployment of those sites, but it's very much an operational, the U.S.-based sites are very much operational. We are focusing on schools and we're focusing on air sampling, and we're doing working really closely with public health to look at sequencing sequences of viruses in schools and working on deploying these air samplers, as we talked about. And our counterparts around the country are doing the same. So it's off the ground, and we're taking it one day at a time.
And when we and it's off the ground, and when another one happens, or even this one, you just hope that we can communicate to our publics the the need to take the recommendations and to act quickly. If you can act quickly, isn't that right, David or Shelby? I mean, if we can act quickly, we can nip this in the bud, Shelby.
Yeah, I mean, it's important for the public to be patient, and I'm sure we're all losing patience now because we're kind of tired of having to wear masks or hearing about COVID and whatever for the last year and a half. So I realize people are tired, but it really is important for us to remember to be patient and to work together and to do things for the good of the community so that we can have a more consistent, comprehensive response to whatever we face. And, you know, if we can detect virus outbreaks more quickly and the community can come together quickly, then you're right. We're going to be able to respond again more quickly to what's coming out there and try to nip things in the bud before they become large outbreaks. But that community response is really just so, so critical.
And again, though, it's always going to be hard, right? Let's not have any delusions here. The next time this happens, it's going to be a mess in different ways. No matter what we do, it's going to be a mess. And, you know, I think that the big difference between this one and HIV in the early 1980s, frankly, is the internet. And that cuts both ways. There are great things about the internet in terms of its ability to disseminate information globally very quickly. But as we've all seen, it's also a cesspool of misinformation. And it creates the scenario where people are making decisions that aren't necessarily driven by experts. And among experts, among scientists, we also disagree. We used to disagree behind closed doors. No one would see how the sausage gets made. And we would respectfully get together with our colleagues and we would look at the same data and we would come at it from and have different conclusions. And those things that used to be aired privately are now out in the public domain, and people see this and it becomes really easy to lose trust in science and scientists, because you hear one scientist and they say, you know, boosters aren't necessary. You could talk to another scientist like me. I actually happen to think that we should be more aggressive with boosters. That doesn't mean that any of the scientists are wrong. We just look at the data and we see, draw different interpretations from the data that's available. And as new data becomes available, as scientists, we're taught to become really intellectually flexible, to change our minds, that's a good thing.
The classic example is the face mask wearing, right? Where everyone said when we first encountered this pandemic, well, shouldn't be wearing face masks. We don't need to wear them. At that time, the healthcare workers needed them and they weren't readily available. And then it came to, well, we all need to wear masks. And people asking, well, why did you change your mind on this? Well, because the science told us we needed to wear masks and we now have them available to us. And we have to respect the fact that as scientists, our thoughts evolve and the public just needs to be, you know, accepting of that.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how this the Institute goes, David and Shelby. And I hope you'll agree to come back down the road here and talk with us again about it. It's a fascinating concept. I'm really hoping hope this helps. And I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure, Larry. Yep. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. David O'Connor, the UW Medical Foundation Professor of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at UW-Madison. Shelby O'Connor, Associate Professor in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine. We'll get him back, and this is something else I want to talk about down the road and sort of keep track of what's going on in that area. Another area we have to worry about Wisconsin has to do with falls. The death rate from falls for older folks in Wisconsin is way high nationally, and we'll talk about why and what we can do about it next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.